Hey everybody, I just wanted to say a really quick note about this episode. We recorded this live at Convergence last year. It's a little bit late, obviously, but we recorded it outside, and there was wind during our interview. I didn't realize at the time how much the wind had spiked in the audio, so I've done my best to remove as much of that as possible from the audio. Most of it's gone, but there are a couple of brief moments where Craig's audio is a little bit obscure. It's kind of hard to hear what he has to say. I really don't have the tools to be able to fully correct those, but they're super brief moments. Like, we're talking a couple seconds here or there. But overall, I think the wind is not an issue with the episode. So hopefully it's not too much of a problem, and I hope you really enjoy the interview. On a side note before I shut up, we could really use your love on iTunes, because if you review us on iTunes, it helps us get closer to being a little bit more visible on the iTunes boards. And so if you use iTunes, or even if you don't and you just like our show, if you could go on iTunes and just leave a review for us, that would be awesome. So please consider doing that. It helps us a lot. It helps spread the word about us, and the more the merrier. So thanks for listening, being a listener throughout, and I hope you enjoy this.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things I don't kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
The Cage Match World City Conflict between Leonardo and Galileo interview with Craig Cormack.
I'm Sean.
I'm David.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Craig.
Hello!
Hello!
Hello! So, you came all the way from a very far off place.
I did. I come from the deep, deep south.
Yes.
The deep, deep, deep south.
If it's not apparent from the accent.
Australia. That's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one hell of a flight. It's like a bazillion and a half hours, isn't it?
It was. It took, I think, 30 hours door-to-door. The actual flight across the Pacific Ocean is about 16 hours. I gather it's one of the longest flights you can take in the world from Sydney to Dallas. But I don't mind long flights. You watch a few movies, have a snooze. It's all right. It's a lot. I find 9-hour flights a lot harder because you can't quite get to sleep. You can't quite watch the movies you want to watch. You can't. And you wake up a zombified, but no, the big fight doesn't worry me at all.
Oh, excellent. So you have a new book out, The Shadow Master, from Angry Robot, and you just told us there is a sequel, so we'll have you mention that a little bit. So first tell us a little bit about the book, maybe some kind of your design for when you came up with the idea for it.
Okay, I'll tell you how I came up with the idea. So it's a Renaissance sword and magic type mystery book. And I was in Florence, actually. My day job is a science communicator. And I was at a conference in Florence 2 years ago. And at the end of the conference, I was walking around the Galileo Museum. It's an awesome museum. It has all the early telescopes and cogs and things he designed for doing water and chronometers and so on. And this idea jumped in my head, you know. What if science was like magic? What if when you switched on Galileo's chronometer, for instance, time actually slowed down? What if when you looked through the telescope, you often transported across the universe, and then all sort of flowed from that moment?
I think my mind is getting the way now.
So I looked at that, looked at the Warring Houses at the time, the Medici's and the Lorraine, so I tried to incorporate a lot of Florence history into it, but I had Galileo and Leonardo working for each of the houses, and each of them has this science slash as magic. And, of course, then there's love interest between it, a romance, a Romeo and Juliet type structure as well.
Yeah, and so that was one of the interesting things that not only have you taken these historical figures and sort of rewritten the history, but you've also kind of melded this into a Romeo and Juliet story in a way. And it's just a really interesting sort of combination that you... So what made you want to kind of take the Romeo and Juliet story and then sort of rehash it for a very different set of characters like Galileo,
yeah,
et cetera?
Yeah, I was actually looking for a structure.
Hold on.
So I was looking for a structure to sort of scaffold plot onto, and while it looks like it's Romeo and Juliet, it's actually a classic Italian book called The Betrothed. And The Betrothed is set in the Renaissance era, and it was written in the 18, 50s, I think, roughly off the top of my head. And it has two characters, Lorenzo and Lucia, who I used as their names in the book. And it talks about the plague at the time, talks about the politics at the time and everything. So I structured a bit using that one. But it shows something about the universality of the Romeo and Juliet story that you look at, and it's apparent to Romeo and Juliet. But of course, Shakespeare borrowed it from previous stories, which date right back to, you know, the year zero when it was first used in Roman times.
Yeah. In fact, Shakespeare borrows plots all the time.
Certainly does.
I mean, people in his that were contemporary to him were borrowing and rehashing sort of old ideas, which is a really interesting historical point.
Reuse and recycle. You don't use up all the new ideas. You know, that's no resources left.
Yeah. So, Paul,
do
you want to start?
I do have a question. Thanks to shows like the Borgias, we know a little bit about Italian history or Italian culture. The Medici, that might be familiar to some people, but the Lorraines less so. Did you find it easier to defy and change expectations of the more well-known parts of Italian history you took, or the stuff that people just never really have heard of?
Yeah, I guess I tried to use the known pieces as solid, you know, marker posts in the land. So I kept Medici's fairly close to what's known historically, because people, when you're doing alternative history, it's a real fine balancing act between giving enough familiar land posts that people can get some sense of what's happening, and then changing others. If you change it too drastically, people go, I'm lost. I just don't have a reference point here. If you change it too minimally, people say, well, that wasn't really alternative history, it was just bad history. So you've got to get that balance, and I think that's where I achieved that with.
And with this fusion of science and magic and characters like Galileo, that there's some rather loaded issues involving the church that could come into play here. Were you having some fun with that?
I was, and the church plays a prominent role in this as well as some crazy sects. I'll spell that S-E-C-T-S, just for anybody who gets that wrong. And there is actually a little bit of crazy sex as well, now that I mention it, but not with the priests and the crazy sex. That would be a whole other book. I did have a chance. And a really interesting anecdote. If you go to the Galileo Museum, his mummified finger is there. You can go online and Google this. Google images, Galileo's finger. And in the museum, in a glass bell jar upside down, there's a mummified middle finger, and it's pointing towards the Duomo Cathedral in the middle of Venice. It's like Galileo's last, you know, comeback. It's very funny.
I love that. There have been a few, not a lot of novels that have explored this sort of territory before. I can think of Paul Macaulay's Pasquale's Angel, and a few others. What literary forebears did you have for deciding to set your novel in this time as well to history with magic?
Okay, I've got to give you a confession here. I'm a bit genre naive, or a bit genre challenged, because I've had almost 20 books published, but they're enormously broad. So they're non-fiction, and they're scientific, and they're literary fiction, and they're short stories. And I'm not deeply ingrained in the spec fiction genre. I love it. I love hanging out with the people. I read a lot of it, but I don't read masses and masses of it. So when people often quote me, oh, this is not, you know, I've read John Courtney Grimm, someone told me recently, is this a bit like him? And I said, who?
Yeah, he's another example I was thinking of, but he does Venice, yeah.
Because I've done Venice in the sequel. And at the end of the sequel, I was talking to one of my editors, and they said, oh, so is it anything like John Courtney Grimm? And I said, I've no idea who's John Courtney Grimm. So in a way, I decided, I made an early note early when I started discovering there's a lot of precursors out there. Should I read them and learn a bit more about the styles and that, or should I ignore them and not let them be an influence? And my decision at the end was, no, I'm going to stick to the mainstream history, read as much as I can about the Medici's and the Florence at the time, and make it up myself. Then when I get to the end of it, then I'll go and check a few and make sure I haven't got it badly wrong. So in terms of influences in the genres, there are actually not many I actually could refer to.
So I guess the opposite question then would be is, since it's not specific to genres, who are some writers that you've enjoyed that perhaps had an influence on you of any form?
David Mitchell, Cloud Atlas.
Oh, yeah.
I love it. And that's an interesting book because you can find David Atlas at a con, or you can find him at a mainstream literary festival. And I think a lot of the books I'll really quote, they live in this funny land between them. In Australia, I know we call it slipstream, but I don't know what you call it here, which is for the books that inhabit these spaces between known genres.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great... Did you see the movie?
Yeah.
Did you like the movie, too?
I did, very much.
I was so sad
I
didn't make it out.
There are fans of it out there.
I know, it's a brilliant movie.
I've got this awesome postcard from the movie of Halle Berry But it's one of those cards that should turn your head. It changes the face.
Oh,
and so
cool.
It's got three of her characters, depending on how you look at it. So I stuff it up on the fridge. It's such an awesome postcard.
That is really cool. I mean, for those that don't know much about Cloud Atlas, the actors and actresses repeat their performances as different characters. They cross genders and races. It's really fascinating. And there are moments when you get to the end of the credits and you see the people they played, yeah, and you're like, wait, what?
That's right.
Like, you missed it completely.
She played a white guy? What?
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
It wouldn't have been half the film it became if they hadn't used that through it. It really made a difference, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. So David Mitchell is a very interesting influence. You mentioned already that there is a sequel coming in that's going to be set in Venice.
Yes.
So what was kind of the impetus for setting the sequel in Venice?
Well, I like the idea of Venice because I positioned it, so I do this slightly alternative history. So Florence is a walled city surrounded by plague people, like zombie-like plague people trying to get in. Florence is a floating city. And so it's actually, one, it's movable a little bit, and two, it's held up by magic. And once the magic in that one is starting to decay, parts of it are sinking away into the ocean. And the whole thing there is about the mages, who would control the city, the magic are being assassinated by the Othmen. And the Othmen have their own Turkish-based magic they're trying to inculcate and overtake the city. So it's these two powers. And it's different types of magic fighting, conflicting as they overcome parts of the city will sink or rise.
You're taking the Venice-Ottoman Empire conflict from history and basically putting it into your own world with your magic system. That sounds very cool.
And there's part of the thing I'm overlaying in that. So I've gone back to some of the Shakespeare's Italian plays, three of them in particular, Othello, the real original Romeo and Juliet, and The Merchant of Venice. And I've gone back to the proto-tales that Shakespeare adapted his things from and wove the proto-tales into it. So they're significantly different in some ways from the Shakespeare ones. So I've used references to those throughout in the main characters.
That's interesting. To use that up. David, you want to talk?
Are you thinking of this in terms of a trilogy or something larger, or ongoing? Or?
I'd like to get to a trilogy. I have a third one which would be based on a pilgrimage over the Alps. In the same era, people coming, trying to reach the holy city or whatever, and as they move through the mountain areas, they move through different realms and have different types of realities as they move through the realms. They've been chased the whole way, so it's a chase and a road trip story at the time. But we'll have to see how the first two books go to see whether it gets a trilogy. And I must admit that the book at the end of the first one, there were two things I would have done different in retrospect, which is spend a bit more time explaining the ending, and then flagging within the book that yes, there will be a sequel. They'll explain these things, because the most common abbreviation I've got so far is WTF, which all your listeners will know stands for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
Of course,
they'd be familiar with that expression. So they get the end and go, "What?" So in the comments saying, "I really love the book, but got the ending, and I was lost." So yes, book two will help explain all that.
So without revealing, obviously, because that would be silly to reveal the ending, You say that you, in retrospect, you might have changed it, but what was the reason why you selected it appears to me it must be a shocking ending.
No, not particularly. What I've done is, I think once readers think they're familiar with what's happening, you get then to find out you weren't familiar at all.
Oh, okay.
And as my wife said, you just need to find cleverer readers. And I don't think that's the issue. I don't think it's a problem with readers, but I know readers, particularly in genre fiction, do have expectations of how it's going to go. And you create a world for them. They really want that. Then when you pull the rug out from under them right at the end, they go, "What? What do you mean my understanding the whole time wasn't based on anything?" And strangely enough, the reviews I've gotten have either like 2 out of 5 or 5 out of 5. And it's got this funny shape of the rock and roll horns happening. And so those who get it really get it and say, "Oh, I love that. You pull the rug out from under me. I thought I knew it was happening." And those who don't get it or prefer the familiar ground say, "I didn't like the way you did that to me. That unsettled me. You know, I suddenly found I was lost. I wanted to get to an end and be comfortable with where I was."
Were you consciously challenging that convention?
That was the whole point. I wanted to say the Shadow Master, the mate you get in, you still don't know much about him. And that's frustrating, you know. So, in fact, you know less about him at the end than you thought you knew what he was, and you realise it's not like that at all. And pulling the rug out from people. Clearly some people thought that's great and they love it, and some people find it very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Suck it up, readers.
Oh. But at the same time, a book that kind of goes against that tradition, I mean, even if some people don't like it, there's an inherent value to that. But their reaction is, I didn't like that, because you kind of succeeded in a way, right?
That's a very good point. And, you know, and one of my drives in writing a book is not just to write a book people say, yeah, I like that. I want to challenge people. I want to make them think a bit harder. If at the end of writing anything, people go away and think, look, I'm not sure I liked it, but gee, it stuck in my head for a couple of days. It made me frustrated or it made me think or something. Then I think, yeah, I've achieved something.
Do you think that comes from your background as a science communicator?
Could do, or as a troublemaker and a stirrer. It could be mean provocative. But I like to think that there are enough books out there that are just plain sword and sorcery. You read it, and it's like a Chinese takeaway meal. You read it, and you've forgotten it straight away. But I wanted to do something a little different.
So I actually wanted to go back to, you mentioned very briefly at the very beginning of this, the way in which you've incorporated science as a kind of magic in this. And you've obviously taken some very, very familiar names, Galileo and Leonardo, huge names. But could you talk a little bit more about this idea of sort of incorporating science as a magical system, which it doesn't happen very often in fantasy, for sure. Which usually, if we get scientific magic, it just means that we got a rigid magic system, not necessarily science-y magic.
Or we get science as a conflict with magic.
Right.
Yeah. And you could argue that, you know, in the early days of science, we go back to medieval ages, science was magic. The whole point of alchemy was to find a way to turn, you know, base metals into gold. Metamorphosis was existing in other areas. Well, why couldn't you do that with gold? You know, it's only because we have more knowledge bases, I guess, now, that either limits our understanding of what magic could be or where it can't be. So why not project that one further and find a way and say, well, you know, why not we have a universe that spun slightly differently where you could actually have those things working that way? And so one thing I have, Leonardo da Vinci's famous bird wings. When you strap on, you morph into a giant eagle. The first chapter, there's the submarine he invented. You put in, you become a giant whale, so you can be, you know, attacking ships under there. So,
oh, fascinating.
Yeah. So, have you thought of going back someday to the proto-scientific experiments of the ancient Greeks, like say 3rd, 4th century BC, and looking at science and magic through the lens of your magic system there at some point in your world?
I hadn't yet, but damn, that's a good idea, because throughout this book, they refer to the ancients. And they've lost knowledge of the ancients. But the ancients had these powers, and they were controlling of them. And it's like Galileo and Leonardo refinding them. And if anything, the ancients, I guess, would be the Romans, Greeks, and Egyptians who we're referring to. I keep it a bit vague, just talk about the ancients. So, yeah.
So that opens a lot of possibilities, the kind of knowledge that could, I mean, that is left unsaid.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's definitely opens
And up. I think that, you know, summed up the Renaissance, they talk about as the rebirth of civilization, but the way they'd come out of the Dark Ages, also rediscovering things that had been known a thousand years earlier.
Yeah, getting these old texts from the fall of Constantinople and the Arabs and whatnot, and relearning science that had been lost for a very long time.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or visiting the place, sacking it, burning it down, losing it forever.
Well, there's that.
There's that too.
There was that too.
Which presents many problems, and annoying problems, because of all that information lost. I'm assuming you meant the Library of Alexandria, which I still am steamed about, even though I was not alive. It's not fair. It's not right. You should never burn down libraries. That's just evil.
So, you know, there's one person who once had their library card revoked back in the time, and they got so angry about it, they burnt down the Library of Alexandria. So librarians shouldn't revoke library cards either.
You say that there might be a personal story there like you. Did you have a library card revoked?
One of my kids' books, we used to have a school librarian who was a bit of a Nazi librarian, and one of my kids' books has this team of librarians who parasail out of helicopters, kicking windows in their granny buns and their stormtrooper things when there's a book one day overdue to, you know, crash into kids' bedrooms and get it back. So there may be some issues being worked out there.
Well, something that you did kind of mention there, that this is somewhat of a different sort of book that you've written before. I mean, you said you've written nonfiction, scientific work. You've just mentioned some other kinds of work. For you, what was kind of the difference in writing this book from some of your other work? Or what were kind of the other pathways? Or maybe was it difficult to kind of switch genres? I use that loosely.
I didn't find that too hard and difficult. In fact, I had 4 months off from work with a literature grant at the time, and I was writing a mainstream book, which was a travel, historical travel book. And when I finished the grant early, I thought I'm going to, I had, you know, 6 weeks left, and thought, you know what I'd like to do in those 6 weeks? I'd like to write that book I had the idea about in the Galileo Museum. So I sat down and went, 4 weeks, wrote the book, and then 2 weeks of thinking about it and revising it and going back to it. So it actually wrote very, very fast. Faster, I guess, than some other books I've worked really hard at. And I actually found because I wasn't putting... I didn't overthink it, overplan it, overplot it. I just thought, this is going to be fun to write. So the first draft was just writing a lot of fun and action. Second draft, tidying it up, making the language better, making it as good as it could be. But I thought the books would be the one, the literature book I was writing, would get published first, and this one probably never would. In fact, it's the other way around.
And
I haven't actually got the other one published yet. Right. And Angry Robots picked this one up, so, you know, go figure.
Go figure. Yeah,
the Australian science fiction scene is actually relatively small, at least compared to the worldwide one. I'm just curious why you brought it, what prompted you to bring it to Angry Robot rather than staying a little more close to home.
You touched on exactly the point, really, because the local market is so small. And some of the stuff, and I've got a friend as well who writes science fiction and fantasy using Australian historical themes throughout. But you can get short stories published in that level, but trying to get novels published, the market is small, and, you know, spec fiction people are a global audience. You could do it within context of series and things, but I think it's not a path to publishing success really to pursue that.
Yeah. So as an Australian author, I mean, are you at all familiar with the genre scene at all? I mean, I know you said
I go to the cons, I've met some of the people. I'm only, a recent convert across to the community about 2 years. And I've got to say, the big difference between having spent 12 years going to mainstream literature conferences and 2 or 3 years going to cons is that no one seems to walk out of the con with a knife in their back, which is really bizarre, because in the literature, mainstream literary conferences, they're so bitchy, you know. And in the community within spec fiction, everybody celebrates each other's success. Oh. Cue by a team present.
I think we're good now.
There's a cohesiveness amongst the spec fiction community. I really enjoy, and I don't find that same one in the mainstream literary.
I think M.D. Lachlan might have mentioned a few years back had a similar opinion. I think he's a British author and was writing maybe mystery novels or something, and then he switched to writing a fantasy novel, and he said
he was doing historical novels too.
Yeah, and then he said when he switched over, he found that fantasy sci-fi, the community was much more supportive. That there are people oh, that's cool, you got a new book, that's great.
Good for you, Robin, you lost it.
Whereas when he was in mystery, it was sort of like everybody seemed like they were in competition. Yep. They were trying to destroy one another.
Yeah.
And he just felt like that's a problem in and of itself.
It's a huge problem. And strangely enough, because, you know, you wouldn't say it's easy to get published in one genre. I wouldn't say the ego is necessarily, perhaps a bit stronger in some of the mainstream fiction. But for whatever reason, within the spec fiction community, people are much more supportive. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice place to be.
Yeah.
Good damn, they party.
Yes, we really do.
So what prompted you to come here, across the world, to the largest science fiction con west of Chicago and north of Iowa for most year? I mean, there's 7,000 people here. It must be very different than even most of the larger Australian cons.
It is. It's bigger than the Australian. We had WorldCon in Australia before, which probably got up to that scope. So I talked to Angry Robot publishers and said, okay, if I want to come and do a bit of a post-promo tour, where would I go? Should I go to WorldCon in London? Or should I go to what? And he said, no. Convergence in Minneapolis, that's the one to go to. And the difference is there, WorldCon is just so big, if you're not a big name personality, you get lost. The smaller cons, he said, you can make a name, you get on a lot of panels a lot easier, get yourself known amongst a bit of a community, meet people, maybe even do radio interviews. You never know.
Never know.
And he said, look, that's a much better place to start. And I've got to say, it was a really good call, because I'm loving this con.
It's my first as well.
Convergent.
I would agree. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Very fan-oriented, yes. Lots of fans. Yep. Even when the panels I've been on have been great. So I'd agree. You picked a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I've been to WorldCon, too, and that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
But it is a very different feel.
We are very proud of Convergent.
You should be, too. And the scale of here is enough that you can meet new people every day, but not so much you become, I'm not going to talk to you, the who the hell are you?
Yeah.
So
Yeah, I mean, it could certainly be very off-putting. Like, you go, I mean, I hear things like about Comic-Con, you know, you get San Diego Comic-Con, it's like a bazillion and a half people there.
And it's like personality-driven, so if you're not, so everyone's there on celebrity hunts.
Right, and it is something that in the more literary side of the field, you know, with some exceptions, people talk to each other. I mean, you could be a small-time writer and have a conversation with somebody much larger, Scott Lynch or something, or maybe George R. R. Martin if he ever leaves. Scott Lynch.
No, I'm just joking.
No, sorry.
That's why I'm joking. Yes.
But yeah, you can have these conversations. You can have a drink with some of these people. Where I feel like, you know, if you're a small-time media personality...
Stop drinking with George R. Martin, anybody out there. Make him go home and work. Make him go home and finish those bloody books.
There is a song about this very problem.
He doesn't know about the song, do you?
No.
We'll have to show you the song.
George, I'm just going to put it in blunt terms. There's a song called George R. R. Martin Is Not Your Bitch. I think it's by John Anelia,
John
right?
Anelia, yeah.
It's really clever. It's a really clever song. Because there was when I think he said he'd had to delay the fifth book for like a year, and there's this outcry on the internet. Everyone's like, get off your ass, stop doing anthologies, go home and write. And then he wrote the song, and it was
actually Neil Gaiman wrote a response that had that line.
That's right. He wrote the whole essay about it. Like, George R. R. Martin's not your bitch. Okay, so there is a plan for a second book. We've talked a little bit about it. Do you have a time when you think that's going to be out?
Yep, I've done the first draft already, or done the second draft finished, and I've got a very eagle-eyed friend of mine in Australia, Tessa Kahn, who's reading over it for me, and based on her comments, it's due on the 1st of August with the publisher, which is getting close.
Very
so
close,
I'll have that knocked off before then.
Excellent. And this one's already out because it came out in June?
A week and 2 weeks ago. End of June.
End of June. So that means everybody should go check out The Shadow Master. It's currently available Angry Robots in mass markets, and I'm sure it's available
in e-books and books and any good bookstore. You go in your bookstore, they haven't got it. They're a bad bookstore.
Yeah, they're bad. They're not good people. They got to carry all the books. What are they doing?
That's right.
So great. So really quick, tell us where people could find you on the interwebs.
You can find me on the interweb thing under www.craigcormick.com.
Okay.
A list of all my books and samples and pictures and pretty things.
Excellent. Would you, out of curiosity, just a second recommendation, since this is a fantasy novel, would you recommend any of your other work? What would you recommend for someone else to try from your other work?
Depends what people have a penchant to, because I do write across lots of genres and lots of backgrounds, but people can have a browse there and have a look at some books and say, that book's interesting, and check them out.
Awesome.
A lot of them on Amazon.
Yep, and if you go to his website, there is a little page that says Works, and it's got all of his stuff in there, and there's lots of good stuff. So thank you very much, Craig, for giving us your time.
Thanks, fellas. That was awesome.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you.
Cool. And on that note, awkward ending. And scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.